Let's get started. This is lecture three, and today I want to talk about hop bifurcations. And let me just remind you where we stand in the outline. In the first lecture, I argued that bifurcation diagrams are equivalent to the physiologist's signal response curves, and that there are only a limited number of generic bifurcation diagrams in nonlinear dynamical systems. And last week, we talked about saddle node bifurcations, which underlie the phenomena of bistability and switching. And today, I want to talk about hop bifurcations, which are one of the fundamental bifurcations that create oscillatory solutions. So you can think of these as switches and clocks. And that's one way that molecular control systems can process information, by flipping between alternative stable steady states or by generating oscillations. So let me just remind you again about the stability analysis of nonlinear differential equations. We start with a general system of nonlinear differential equations describing the time rate of change of the variables in our system. Their activities are given by x sub I. I runs from 1 to n, so there can be any number of variables that we need to describe this dynamical regulatory system. A steady state of the dynamical system is a place where all the rates are equal to zero. So if all the rates for every variable is zero, then nobody's changing in time, and that's the definition of a steady state solution. And I'll always indicate the steady state by the superscript naught at the steady state. Once we find a steady state, we can examine its stability by looking at the characteristics of the vector field close to the steady state. So we introduce these new variables, delta sub I, which is a small deviation away from the steady state, and we write the differential equations in terms of these small deviations, and we keep only the linear terms in the power series expansion around the steady state. We neglect the nonlinear terms because if the delta j's are small, then delta j squared is really tiny and delta j cubed is infinitesimal. You can neglect those higher order terms, and the whole vector field is dominated by the linear part of the rate functions. Okay, and by the linear part, I mean that these coefficients, the aij's, are the derivatives of the rate function. Aij is the derivative of the ith rate function with respect to the jth variable, so evaluated at the steady state. So at the steady state, all the rates cancel each other out so that the net rate is equal to zero. But the rates in the different directions are not necessarily zero. The gradient of the vector field is not necessarily zero. And that's described by the elements of this matrix, the Jacobian matrix, and that's going to determine the stability of the steady state. Okay? So we linearize the differential equations around the steady state, and then we have to solve a set of linear differential equations. But we know how to do that. The general solution of a set of linear differential equations is a sum of n independent solutions, and those independent solutions are of the form e to the lambda t, that's a scalar function of time, times some constant vector v sub I. And the lambda I and v sub I are the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the Jacobian matrix. So once we've determined the Jacobian matrix, we have to find its eigenvalues and eigenvectors, and then we can describe the nature of the solution of the differential equations in the vicinity of the steady state. Now, the eigenvalues of a matrix are defined by this algebraic equation. You take the Jacobian matrix and subtract lambda from each element of the diagonal, and then you compute the determinant of that matrix and set it equal to zero. It's a complicated expression, but this is just a fact of life from linear algebra. This is how you find the eigenvalues of a matrix J. The expansion of the determinant of this n by n matrix will eventually lead to an nth degree polynomial in the eigenvalues lambda. So the leading order term is lambda raised to the nth power, and the next term, lambda to the n minus first power, is multiplied by the negative trace of the Jacobian matrix. And finally, the constant term in this algebraic equation is the determinant of the Jacobian matrix. And I put dot, dot, dot in between because it's actually very difficult to write down in general what those, what the coefficients are of the intermediate terms. They're complicated functions of the Jacobian matrix J. Okay, so this is an nth degree polynomial in lambda in with real coefficients. So we know that it has n solutions. There are going to be n eigenvalues, solutions, and those eigenvalues are either real numbers or complex conjugate pairs. And we have to classify the nature of those eigenvalues. Okay? Last week we talked about the case when the determinant of the Jacobian matrix is equal to zero. In that case, the constant term in this algebraic equation is equal to zero. And every other term in the equation is multiplied by a lambda, which means lambda equals zero is a solution of the eigenvalue equation whenever the determinant is of the Jacobian is equal to zero. And a lambda equals zero, a zero eigenvalue, is the indication of a saddle node bifurcation. What happens when the determinant of the Jacobian goes to zero is that a stable node comes together with an unstable saddle point, and they coalesce at the bifurcation point to form this structure, which we call a saddle node. And then when the parameter increases a little bit further, the saddle node disappears, and now there is no longer a steady state there. The vector field just flows through that region of the state space. Okay, so that's how saddles and nodes come and go whenever the determinant of the Jacobian matrix is equal to zero. And that's indeed how we find saddle node bifurcations, is by examining the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix and looking for situations where the determinant passes through zero. That's the signature of a saddle node bifurcation. So what about a hop bifurcation? Hop bifurcations are a little different. In this case, the vector field undergoes a hop bifurcation and creates periodic solutions whenever the Jacobian matrix has a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues. Okay? So lambda has a real component plus or minus I times the imaginary part of the eigenvalue. And a hop bifurcation occurs whenever the real part of the eigenvalue equals zero, meaning the eigenvalues are purely imaginary, plus or minus I times the imaginary part. And when that occurs, that's when the steady state is undergoing a hop bifurcation. And in the simplest case, which is what we call a supercritical hop bifurcation, the stable steady state, and it's a focus because the eigenvalues are complex conjugate with negative real part. Okay, so there's an oscillatory part of the solution that comes from the imaginary part of the eigenvalue, and there's a damped part of the solution that comes to e to the minus real part times t. Okay. And when the real part changes sign and becomes positive, then the steady state becomes unstable and trajectories start to wind away from the steady state. They're growing in time, but they're captured by a stable limit cycle, a small amplitude stable limit cycle in the vicinity of the stable steady state. And this is the situation that's assured by the Hopf bifurcation theorem, which I'll state in just a second. But there's another situation, another possibility, and that is that the small amplitude periodic solutions exist on the other side of the bifurcation, where the steady state is a stable steady state, and the limit cycles are unstable limit cycles. Okay. Now, ignore the limit cycle, and both of these situations look the same. For parameter values below the Hopf bifurcation, the steady state is a stable focus here, it's a stable focus here. And for parameter values above the Hopf bifurcation, the steady state is an unstable focus. In the case of a supercritical Hopf bifurcation, trajectories wind away from an unstable focus and they wind onto a stable limit cycle. In the case of a subcritical bifurcation, the limit cycle is unstable and trajectories wind away from the unstable limit cycle down onto the stable steady state. And on the other side of the limit cycle, the trajectories are winding away from this limit cycle and leaving the vicinity of the steady state. Now, once they leave the vicinity of the steady state, there's no telling what happens to them, because this is a linear analysis in the neighborhood of the steady state, and it can only be trusted as long as we're close to the steady state. But this analysis predicts that the trajectories are leaving the vicinity. And to find out what happens to them, you have to go back to the original differential equations and look at the nonlinear terms. Once you're past the bifurcation, the steady state is unstable, and there are no stable attractors in the vicinity of the steady state, so the trajectories have to leave, and presumably they'll find a stable attractor someplace else. But as I said, we can't figure out what that is as long as we're relying on the linear theory. Okay? So the point is that whenever a steady state loses stability because a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues moves from having negative real part to having positive real part, whenever that happens, there is always born a family of small amplitude limit cycles in the vicinity of the steady state. But those limit cycles come in two different flavors. If it's a supercritical Hopf bifurcation, it's creating stable limit cycles. If it's a subcritical Hopf bifurcation, it's creating unstable limit cycles. So here's a statement of the Hopf bifurcation theorem. Let's see if this makes sense. Suppose that at a certain value of a parameter P, and we call that value P sub H. So P sub H is a constant. It's the location of the Hopf bifurcation. So when our parameter takes the value P sub H, we suppose that the Jacobian matrix has a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues with real part equal to zero. And furthermore, as we change P through P sub H, the real part of the eigenvalue is changing. And we'll assume that the derivative of the real part with respect to P is a positive number. See? So when P is equal to pH, the real part is zero. When P is larger than pH, the real part is bigger than zero, because we're assuming the slope is positive. So when P is less than pH, the real part is negative. Okay, so these are the conditions. You have to have a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues that are actually crossing the imaginary axis. They lie to the left side with real part less than zero when P is below the bifurcation point, and they lie on the other side of the imaginary axis when P is greater than P sub H. So they have to cross the imaginary axis. If those conditions are satisfied, then the theorem assures you that for a small distance away from the Hopf bifurcation point, to one side or the other, we're not saying which, but for values of P close to the Hopf bifurcation point, there exists a one-parameter family of small amplitude limit cycles for one of the following three conditions. First of all, it may be that the limit cycles exist when P is larger than P sub H, in which case the limit cycles are stable. Or these limit cycles may exist for P less than the bifurcation point, in which case the limit cycles are unstable. And the third possibility is that the limit cycles only exist precisely for the value P equals PH, in which case the limit cycles are neutrally stable. They're neither stable attractors nor are they unstable. And I'm not going to... What's going on? I'm not going to try to describe case 3 because case 3 is very unusual. It hardly ever happens. It's a mathematical possibility, but you never see case 3, so there's no point in worrying about it. In cases 1 and 2, the limit cycles are parameterized by their distance from the bifurcation point. So I have to explain this a little bit more detail, I guess. When I say there's a one-parameter family of limit cycles, I mean that there's a whole bunch of limit cycles, not just one limit cycle. There's a whole bunch of limit cycles, an infinity of limit cycles. But they're parameterized by just one quantity. Whatever that quantity is, I have to tell you what it is. As I change that parameter, I change from one limit cycle to the next. And in cases 1 and 2, the parameter that you can use to identify the limit cycle is just how far away from the bifurcation point you are. So the parameter is the distance, the absolute value P minus PH. And so if you pick a particular value of P, there is a particular limit cycle. But if you change P a little bit, then you'll get a different limit cycle, because the limit cycles depend upon the value of this parameter, of this distance from the Hopf bifurcation point. And what's different about the limit cycles is their amplitude. The amplitude of the limit cycles grows like the square root of the distance from the bifurcation point. But the period of the limit cycles doesn't change very much with this parameter. The period of the limit cycles is always close to 2 pi divided by the imaginary part of the eigenvalue. Now, all this sounds very confusing when you try to state it in precise language like this mathematically, but intuitively, it's actually very simple and makes a whole lot of sense. I don't know why my computer is misbehaving. Okay. But let's draw the one parameter bifurcation diagram for a supercritical Hopf bifurcation. Now remember, in a one parameter bifurcation diagram, I plot some dynamical characteristic of the system. I take one of the variables of the system and I plot it on the vertical axis against the parameter P that I'm changing. So it's a one-parameter bifurcation diagram. As I change the parameter P, the qualitative nature of the solutions of the differential equations changes, and I'm trying to pick up that change by monitoring one of the variables. Okay? And this is the situation at a supercritical Hopf bifurcation. When the parameter P is less than PH, the steady state is stable, because all the eigenvalues have negative real parts. as I increase the parameter P and cross the bifurcation point, now the steady state becomes unstable because now there's a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues with positive real part, and the steady state is an unstable focus. And as I cross the bifurcation point, that's when the small amplitude limit cycles start to appear. And I characterize the limit cycles on the bifurcation diagram by plotting the maximum value of x and the minimum value of x when you go around the limit cycle. So if I pick a particular value of p that's above the Hopf bifurcation point, then the variable x will oscillate up and down with time between the maximum and the minimum. And for any particular value of p, there's only one limit cycle. At this value of p, there's this limit cycle. At this value of p, there's this limit cycle. But in the bifurcation diagram, the limit cycles all fit together as a one-parameter family, parameterized by the distance from the bifurcation point. And the amplitude of the limit cycles grows as you move away from the Hopf bifurcation point, and it grows in a very special way. It grows like a square root function of the distance from the bifurcation point. Okay? So this curve that hooks together the maxima and the minima is actually a parabola lying on its side. It's a square root function. Okay, so this is what the bifurcation diagram looks like, and beneath it is what the phase space, the state space, looks like. As you go past the bifurcation point, you get stable limit cycles surrounding an unstable steady state. And as we move away from the bifurcation point, that limit cycle gets bigger and bigger. Okay, question? How far you can go? No. The theorem doesn't tell you how far you can go. It only tells you that this is true close. And how close is close depends upon the nonlinearities in the real differential equation. But this gets you started. Okay? I'm going to tell you how to follow the limit cycles in just a second. Okay? Go back to the theorem, sure. This derivative, yeah, see, the eigenvalues depend upon the parameters, right? Because the steady state depends upon the parameters. Yeah, you should write it as a partial derivative and evaluate it at a particular point. It's evaluated at the place where the bifurcation is occurring. Okay? So all I'm trying to indicate here is that as the parameter changes, the eigenvalues move across the imaginary axis. The real part is equal to zero, and then you go a little bit further, and now the real part is positive. You want to make sure that the real part is changing sign. Okay? And it doesn't matter. If actually the derivative is negative, that just means you're going in the opposite direction. It's just that the derivative has to be different from zero. We usually assume it's positive, but if it's negative, you just go in the opposite direction. Okay? So this is what all supercritical Hopf bifurcations look like this. If you've seen one, you've seen them all. They all have this appearance. And all subcritical Hopf bifurcations have this appearance. There's still a one-parameter family of periodic solutions, and they live along this locus, which the amplitude is described by the square root of the distance from the bifurcation point. But now the family of small amplitude limit cycles lives on the other side of the bifurcation. It lives on the side of the bifurcation where the steady states are stable, and therefore the limit cycles are unstable. And the associated diagram in state space is the one down here, an unstable limit cycle surrounding a stable steady state. And again, what happens as you follow these things away from the bifurcation point, you can't predict from the linear terms in the differential equations. Oh yeah, the period of the limit cycle. So the period of the limit cycle is basically given by how fast you're spinning around the steady state, right? But how fast you're spinning around the steady state is exactly given by the imaginary part of the eigenvalue. Okay? Because when you have... When you have a complex conjugate eigenvalue, the real part goes to the e to the lambda t. The real part sits there, and the imaginary part is a sine and a cosine of omega t, where omega is the imaginary part of the eigenvalue. And that's the frequency. The imaginary part of the eigenvalue is the frequency that solutions are rotating around the steady state. So the period, if the imaginary part is the frequency, then the period is 2 pi divided by the imaginary part. So these limit cycles inherit that period. And the period of the limit cycles is close to 2 pi divided by the imaginary part of the eigenvalue at the Hopf bifurcation point. Yeah. Okay, so the kind of the velocity at which you're leaving the unstable steady state, that's determined by the real part of the eigenvalue. And of course, close to the Hopf bifurcation point, the real part is very small. It's close to zero. So actually, although you're spinning away from the unstable steady state, you leave it very slowly. You don't approach the limit cycle quickly. Takes a long time to get there. Okay? But it doesn't matter because what you're going to see are oscillations, steady oscillations with a period close to 2 pi over the imaginary part of the eigenvalue. And eventually you'll settle on this stable limit cycle. And if the parameter is changing, the amplitude of that limit cycle is going to get bigger and bigger. But the period won't change too much. Which one do you see more often? They're 50-50 chance. Yeah. You can't really predict very well whether it's going to be supercritical or subcritical. You have to do the calculation to find out. And I'm going to tell you how to do that in just a sec. Okay, any other questions about this picture? Not that I know of. Okay, so let me say it one more time a little bit differently. Hopf bifurcation is one of the classical ways that limit cycles are born in a dynamical system. You can ask the question, if the system is oscillatory, where did those oscillations come from? How did they arise? Okay? And a Hopf bifurcation is one of the ways that limit cycles get born. And when limit cycles are born at a Hopf bifurcation, they have two defining properties. First of all, they're small amplitude limit cycles. So when they're first born, they're just little babies. They have small amplitude. And second, the second property of these solutions, when they're first born, they have a finite period. And the period of the limit cycles is 2 pi over the imaginary part of the eigenvalue. So you know what the period of the oscillation is, and you know the amplitude is very small. Those are the defining characteristics of limit cycles that are born from a Hopf bifurcation. Now, the next time we meet, next week, I'm going to talk about a different way that limit cycles can be born. And they have completely different properties. So I want you to understand what the nature is of these limit cycles that come from Hopf bifurcations, because we're going to see another way that limit cycles are born that's completely different. Okay. Now, of course, to study these bifurcations in a real practical case, we need to use numerical algorithms that carry out all of these calculations for us. And it's nice to know a little bit about how these numerical algorithms work. The most famous software package for numerical bifurcation theory is a package called AUTO, A-U-T-O. And I'm going to describe for you basically how AUTO works, but actually the technical details are not really that important to us. But we need to know the basic idea about how any of these numerical bifurcation software packages work. So, one thing a bifurcation package can identify is a saddle node bifurcation. So how does a software package identify a saddle node bifurcation? That's a question I'm asking the class. How does the software package identify the location of a saddle node bifurcation? Lambda is equal to zero. Or the determinant of the Jacobian matrix is equal to zero. Those are the same thing. Okay? So the software package, it finds steady states for you. That's easy. That's just solving algebraic equation. When it finds a steady state, it then calculates the elements of the Jacobian matrix. That's easy. Once it has the elements of the Jacobian matrix, it finds the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix, and it just watches them. Okay? And if you give it a steady state that's a perfectly stable steady state, everything's fine, it then moves the parameter a little bit and it follows the steady state. And it follows, it keeps its eye on the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix. And if one of the eigenvalues, if the real eigenvalue goes to zero, then it knows it's found a saddle node bifurcation. And similarly, if it's following the eigenvalues and it sees that a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues approaches the imaginary axis, that the real part goes to zero, it knows it's found a Hopf bifurcation. Okay? So just by monitoring the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix, the software can identify these two characteristic bifurcation points. Now, once the software has found the Hopf bifurcation point, it can be sure from Hopf's theorem that close to the bifurcation point, there must exist small amplitude periodic solutions. So the next thing that it tries to do is find those periodic solutions. And I want to describe you how it finds the periodic solutions. Okay? So a periodic solution, x of t, has the property that if you start at some initial state on the periodic solution and you integrate forward in time for one period, you'll come back to where you started. That's what makes it a periodic solution. And it doesn't matter where you start. If you integrate forward in time for a time capital T, the period of the solution, you'll come back to where you started. Okay? So the way the software works is it tries to rescale the time in terms of the period. So you define a new time tall in terms of the clock time divided by the period of the limit cycle. Unfortunately, you don't know what the period of the limit cycle is. That's something you have to find. But once you've rescaled the time by the period, then the solution exists over a known interval. Tau goes from 0 to 1. And whenever tau goes from 0 to 1, the solution, xi, as a function of tau, has to start at some point and wiggle around a bit and then come back exactly to the point where it started. So that's the condition, that it be a periodic solution, and that's called a two-point boundary value problem. You want to start at some point at tau equals 0, integrate forward in time to tau equal 1, and satisfy a boundary condition at the other end, and the boundary conditions are that those two points at the two extremes have to be identical. That's the condition for a periodic solution. Okay? So, if you're close to a periodic solution, then the computer can always twiddle things a little bit. Okay? If the computer knows kind of approximately where to start and knows approximately what the period is, then it can almost satisfy these conditions, and almost is good enough now, because now the computer can twiddle things a little bit, change the period a little bit, change the initial conditions a little bit, and try to satisfy the conditions for a periodic solution. And there are good algorithms for doing that twiddling efficiently and homing in on the periodic solution. So as long as you have a good start, you don't have to be exactly there, but as long as you have a good start, the computer can find the periodic solution by this prescription. Now, then the question is, well, how do you get a good start? And that's where the Hopf bifurcation theorem comes in. Because the Hopf bifurcation theorem assures you that if you're close to the bifurcation point, P sub H, then you know the solution exists. You know that the period of the solution is close to 2 pi over the imaginary part of the eigenvalue. And you know that the waveform can be expressed in terms of sines and cosines. Okay, so you know a lot about the solution that you're expecting to find. And that allows the software to get a good start and then home in on exactly the periodic solution, as long as it's close to the Hopf bifurcation point. And of course, initially it doesn't know whether the periodic solutions are going to exist for P larger than P sub H or for P smaller than P sub H, but it just tries both to see under which conditions it can satisfy these conditions for a periodic solution. And that allows it to get started. Once it gets started, it can always follow a periodic solution by making a small change in P. Okay? So suppose I satisfy these conditions. I have a periodic solution for one value of P. Now, if I make a little change in the value of P, the period will change a little bit, the amplitude will change a little bit, but I won't be very far away. And now I can readjust my description of the periodic solution and satisfy the conditions again. And that way I can follow the periodic solution as long as I make small changes in the parameter. And that's exactly what the bifurcation software does. And that's how it traces out these bifurcation diagrams. Because initially, it was following the stable steady state, and it saw that the stable steady state loses stability with a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues crossing the imaginary axis. Then it goes back to the Hopf bifurcation point, and it looks for periodic solutions close by. And it either finds stable ones on this side, or it finds unstable ones on that side. And then it knows which direction to go, and it follows the periodic solutions, and you can watch them as the software is doing the calculations. You just watch them grow in amplitude as they move away from the Hopf bifurcation point. But now, the bifurcation software is no longer relying on the linearization of the differential equations anymore. It's now solving the full set of differential equations, so it can in principle follow this family of periodic solutions far away from the Hopf bifurcation point. The amplitude will get very big, and the periodic solutions may do crazy things that we haven't talked about yet. But the software can find them where they're born and then follow them as they grow up to be big limit cycles. And we'll have to talk later about what happens to them when they grow up. Okay? Sometimes they become teenagers and they do crazy things, and we'll have to figure out exactly what to expect. But the software can do these computations for us. Any questions so far? Yes? As P changes, the imaginary part changes. But the period, once you get away from the bifurcation point, the period no longer has to be close to 2 pi. It starts off close to 2 pi over the imaginary part. But as you move away from the bifurcation point, the amplitude gets bigger, and the period can start to change. It's not damped. No, these are true periodic solutions, not damped. They have a finite amplitude. Now they're big, grown-up limit cycles. And the period is different from 2 pi over the imaginary part. Okay? So the bifurcation theorem only tells you what they look like when they're babies. All babies look the same, right? You know that. But once they grow up to adults, they all look different. Okay? So the bifurcation theory tells you how to find them when they're first born. And then the software is able to follow them and watch them as they grow up. Okay. In particular, the software can follow the stability of the limit cycles as they grow up and move away from the bifurcation point. Now, Hopf's bifurcation theorem tells you what their stability is when they're first born. But as they grow up, they can change their stability, and the software has to follow the stability of the limit cycles. Just like the software can follow the stability of a steady state by monitoring the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix, the linearization close to the steady state, the software can also follow the stability of the limit cycles as the parameter changes and as the limit cycles get big. And it does that by monitoring the behavior of the vector field close to the limit cycle. And it's also a linearization argument, but it's a little bit more subtle argument. And let me try to explain it. The stability of a periodic solution is determined by things called Floquet multipliers. So the Floquet multipliers for a periodic solution are something like the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix for a steady state solution. And it's the location of the Floquet multipliers in the complex plane that are going to determine the stability of the periodic solution. But let me explain what a Floquet multiplier is. It's a little more complicated. Let's define a plane P that's transversal to the periodic solution at a particular point. So I've tried to draw this. In general, we're in an n-dimensional state space. And a periodic solution is a one-dimensional trajectory through an n-dimensional state space. And it can wander all around, but eventually it has to come back and close on itself if it's a periodic solution. So here's my periodic solution. It starts at the black dot. It wanders around in the n-dimensional state space, and eventually it comes back to that point. And this black dot on the periodic solution can be anywhere. It doesn't matter which point I pick. Just pick a point on the periodic solution and then construct a plane that's transversal to the periodic solution. Okay? Because we want to look at what's happening close to the periodic solution. Now, let x at time 0 be a point in the plane P, but not the point on the periodic solution. The point on the periodic solution I'll call x naught. Okay? And I want to pick a starting condition that's close to, but not exactly on, the periodic solution. And y0 is the distance of my starting point from the periodic solution. So y0 is a little vector in this plane, P, that tells me how far away from the periodic solution I am. Okay? Now, if I start at the point x0 and go around, I come right back to x0. But if I start at some other point, y0, and follow the vector field round and round and round, eventually I'll come back to the plane P. But I won't come back to y0. I'll come back to some new point, y1, which is the value of my state variable sometime capital T later. Capital T is the time it took to go around and come back to the plane P. Okay? So, this prescription describes what a mathematician would call a mapping. It maps one point on the plane P, y0, into the next point on the plane, y sub 1. And then we can repeat it. We can start at y1, go around, and come to y2. And y2 to y3. So this prescription describes a mapping that takes yk to yk plus 1 by going round, once round. And in general, that's a complicated nonlinear function. But if we are close to the periodic solution, we can always linearize this nonlinear function in the neighborhood of the periodic solution and describe this mapping by a matrix M. And of course, what a matrix M does to a vector y is to, you start with the vector y sub k, and when you multiply it by a matrix M, in general, what that does is it rotates the vector a little bit, and it dilates or contracts the vector. It makes the vector longer or shorter. And the rotation and the dilation of the vector are determined by the eigenvalues of the matrix M. Okay? So it's the same kind of an argument. We characterize this nonlinear mapping by a linearization, and then we find the eigenvalues of the linearized matrix. And those eigenvalues are the Floquet multipliers. Okay? So we linearize the system, and the eigenvalues of the matrix M, mu sub I, are known as the Floquet multipliers of the periodic solution. And for the periodic solution to be stable, all the Floquet multipliers must lie within the unit circle in the complex plane. So this is a little different. Here's again the complex plane, real part of mu and imaginary part of mu, but now the condition is all the Floquet multipliers have to lie in the unit circle. Now, why is that? Remember, the matrix M can do two things to the vector y. It can rotate the vector y, and it can make it longer or shorter. The rotation of the vector is described by the imaginary part of the Floquet multiplier, and making it shorter or longer is determined by the magnitude of the Floquet multiplier. Not the real part, but the magnitude. Okay? So as long as the magnitude is less than 1, then the effect of the matrix is to make the vector y shorter and shorter each time you multiply by the matrix. As long as the eigenvectors lie within the unit circle, their magnitude is less than 1, and every time you multiply by the matrix M, you make the vector a little shorter. Now, you may also rotate the vector, but the important thing is you make it shorter. So that means every time you go one more time around, you get closer to the limit cycle. That's why the limit cycle is stable if the flow k multipliers lie within the unit circle. If the flow k multipliers escape from the unit circle and get outside the unit circle, then every time you multiply by the matrix, the vector y gets longer and you get further away from the periodic solution. So the periodic solution has to be unstable. Okay? So, you can follow the stability of the periodic solutions by calculating and characterizing the flow k multipliers. And for a computer, that's no harder particularly than getting the Jacobian matrix and getting the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix. It's a little more complicated, but you know, computers are good at this sort of thing. Okay? Furthermore, depending on how the flow k multipliers escape from the unit circle, you get different bifurcations of the periodic solutions. So now we're able to describe the bifurcations that can happen to periodic solutions, not just steady state solutions. And there are three characteristic bifurcations that can occur on periodic solutions. The first one is when a real negative flow k multiplier escapes the unit circle by becoming smaller than minus 1. Now, what does this mean? If a flow k multiplier is a negative number, that means that if I start with a little vector y pointing in this direction, after I go once around, it points in the opposite direction because it gets multiplied by a real negative number. That rotates it by 180 degrees. If the magnitude of the flow k multiplier is less than 1, the little vector got shorter. Okay? So you go around, you end up on the other side of the limit cycle, but you're a little closer. But if the flow k multiplier is more negative than minus 1, then as you go around once, not only do you land on the other side of the limit cycle, but you're further away than when you started. And when you go around the second time, you now end up back on the original side and further away still. So when a flow k multiplier escapes from the unit circle out here, the limit cycle becomes unstable because it goes first to one side and then to the other side. It first gets a little bigger, and then the next time around it's a little smaller, then the next time around it's a little bigger still, and the next time around it's a little smaller. And, of course, that can't continue forever. Eventually what happens is you get a state, this first limit cycle loses stability, and a new limit cycle is gained, a stable limit cycle, which has twice the period. That's why it's called a period doubling bifurcation. The reason it has twice the period is because you have to start on one side, go once around, you don't close on yourself because you're on the opposite side of the limit cycle, then go a second time around and you get back to where you started. So a stable limit cycle can lose stability in this fashion and create a stable limit cycle that has twice the period. That's called a period doubling bifurcation. And again, the software can find these things and catalog them for you. That's one possibility. Yes? No. This is a bifurcation of a periodic solution, and it's called a period doubling bifurcation for the periodic solution. Right? What I'm trying to do in this whole course is to describe for you the standard kinds of bifurcations that you can see. Okay? And we have to learn them. We're going to see new ones every week, okay? And now I'm trying to teach you the standard bifurcations that can happen to a stable limit cycle. When a stable limit cycle loses stability, It loses stability in one of these three ways. The first one is a period doubling bifurcation. The second one is that a real positive flow K multiplier can escape the unit circle by becoming larger than 1, plus 1. In that case, the limit cycle becomes unstable in one characteristic direction. It's still stable in all the other directions, but it's unstable in one direction, and you just keep going further and further away from the limit cycle. You don't do this back and forth business. You just keep going further and further away from the limit cycle. And that's very much like a saddle node bifurcation for steady states. And this bifurcation is called a saddle node bifurcation of periodic solutions, also called a cyclic fold bifurcation. And what happens here, just like at a saddle node bifurcation of stationary states, a stable node comes together with an unstable saddle point and they annihilate each other. At the cyclic fold bifurcation, it's a saddle node of periodic solutions, a stable limit cycle comes together with an unstable limit cycle and they annihilate each other. It's a place where stable and unstable limit cycles are created and destroyed at this cyclic fold bifurcation. And we'll see them in some of our examples later. The third possibility is that a pair of complex conjugate flow K multipliers escapes from the unit circle. In that case, the limit cycle has become unstable in two directions at once. And now, what happens is the vector, not only is the vector increasing in magnitude, but it's rotating around the limit cycle. And basically what is born is a torus or a donut that blows up from the stable periodic solution. The stable periodic solution is a one-dimensional object. But now you put a little circle around the periodic solution and you create a donut. Initially, that's a real skinny little donut, but that can get bigger. So this is like a hop bifurcation of periodic solutions instead of a hop bifurcation of steady state solutions. It creates a donut, and now the stable periodic, the stable attractor is, it's circulating around in the steady state like the original limit cycle, but as it's doing that, it's also rotating around that other circle. So it's a trajectory on a donut that lives in the state space. And it doesn't have to close on itself. It may never close on itself. So it's not strictly a periodic solution, but it's still a stable attractor of the dynamical system. Okay? So things can get pretty complicated, and they can get more complicated still, but these are the elementary bifurcations of a periodic solution. And I think that's where I'm stopping today. Okay, so next week I want to talk about what are called heteroclinic bifurcations. I'll define what they are next week, and I'll show you a completely different way that periodic solutions can be born in nonlinear dynamical systems. And then we'll compare and contrast these two different types of bifurcations for periodic solutions. Okay, see you then.